Welcome to One True Podcast. My name is Mark Chirino, alongside Michael Von Cannon. In his memoir, A Movable Feast, Ernest Hemingway wrote, "All you have to do is write one true sentence. Write the truest sentence that you know." So finally, I would write one true sentence and then go on from there. In that same spirit of honesty, creativity, and curiosity, One True Podcast explores all things related to Ernest Hemingway, his life, his work, and his world. Today's show continues our celebration of the centenary of the Paris in our time by reading the 18 sketches one at a time. And Michael Von Cannon, we are up to chapter 5 today.
I can't believe it.
You didn't think we'd make it this far.
knowing me, no, I didn't think we would. Knowing you, I figured that, you know, you'd make it all the way to 18.
I am just that stubborn. But we have been talking about how these sketches are sort of interrelated in that they continue a theme, and then how each one sort of introduces a new aspect of it. Sometimes find ourselves talking about the same ideas, which I think is probably to be expected. Michael, you were talking last time how chapter 4 and chapter 5 are related. And I'd love for you to weigh in on that. Before you do, though, I would like to turn it over to the great Stacy Keach, who will read chapter 5 from the Simon & Schuster audio collection, The Short Stories. So here is Stacy Keach.
Chapter 5. It was a frightfully hot day. We jammed an absolutely perfect barricade across the bridge. It was simply priceless. A big old wrought iron grating from the front of a house, too heavy to lift, and you could shoot through it and they would have to climb over it. It was absolutely topping. They tried to get over it and we potted them from 40 yards. They rushed it and officers came out alone and worked on it. It was an absolutely perfect obstacle. Their officers were very fine. We were frightfully put out when we heard the flank had gone and we had to fall back.
There we have it, Chapter 5 of In Our Time by Stacy Keach. What a great job. So, Michael, what do you make of the way that Chapter 4 and Chapter 5 relate? Some of these chapters change settings so drastically, but here it's almost like you can make an argument that we have a sequel here.
Yeah, you can. I mean, this is Chapter 4 and 5 are twin chapters in a lot of ways, aren't they? So chapter 4, as we talked about last time, is part one of two of the Battle of the Mons chapters. And so that one begins in a garden. And this one, as we will be talking about, really kind of draws us into, I guess, one part of kind of what's buried there in chapter 4 when, as we remember, young Buckley came in with his patrol from across the river. I mean, we are going to be talking a bit about that river in chapter 5, I guess, when we are discussing the bridge, what the bridge is about, the canal itself. So we are kind of zooming into a particular scene that's just kind of showing up there.
Okay, so the setting is the same. We are in Mons in Belgium in August of 1914.
We had heading to the Champagne region, right? Heading toward the front in chapter 1. Then after that, we get to this bullfighting scene in 2, first matador, right? Got the horn. That's chapter 2. And then Turkey. We are with the Greco-Turkish evacuation in 3. So kind of we're all over the map. And then now we're pinned down to a particular setting, at least for these few, at least for these two.
Yes, exactly.
Vignettes here.
And so we're also to assume, as we discussed in the last episode, that this is an anecdote that Hemingway probably received from Chink Dorman Smith, who experienced this exact battle in 1914. So Hemingway was all of 15 years old when this happened. So this would have been something that Hemingway would have received as an anecdote, captured not only dramatically, but also linguistically, the way that Dorman Smith would have recounted the story.
Yeah, although Hemingway's not going to refer to it as such, this is the clash between the British and German forces at the Mons Condé Canal. And so, yeah, Chink Dorman-Smith would have been there commanding a battalion at that particular canal. So the images of the bridge and waterways are going to be important. But certainly, as you're saying, this is one of many vignettes at this point that comes from someone else. Certainly, just like the previous one, it came from Chink Dorman-Smith. But as we've said before, other ones have come from Robert McAlmon and so on and so forth. And it's so interesting that that's one of the threads throughout this, is that it seems on the surface that this is eyewitness account from Hemingway, that it is journalism or just journalism. But Hemingway seems to be making a point that he can write fiction purely as fiction, but certainly he can write fiction taking that raw material from someone else.
It probably would be worth it to linger on that point for a second, because here we have an American writer in 1924 who is really publishing his first effort, and he is freely capturing voices that are so clearly, not only are they not in America, set in America, but they're not even American voices. And I wonder if we think that that's a courageous move by Hemingway. He's saying like, no, I'm not trying to define myself as having a particularly American inflection. Of course, he's writing these sketches in France, but also he is essentially mimicking the way that Chink Dorman-Smith would have told the story.
I think it is certainly an experimental move that he's wanting to make. I'm thinking about other writers that he's reading who would be doing the same or wanting to do the same kind of thing, you know, ventriloquizing in a certain way, of trying to bring other, trying to bring other voices into their writing and show a sense of mastery of those kinds of voices. And in such a short book of vignettes, having all different kinds of sound to it. I'm also thinking about some of the other works that he's writing around this time that are the longer works that don't necessarily have British voices to them, but have a certain kind of tone that isn't necessarily a Hemingway tone, like My Old Man or something like that, right? That has, it kind of has a juvenile sound to it, and it comes from certainly Sherwood Anderson and Ring Lardner, but he's trying to explore a vocal range and a range in tone that is, although it has a kind of youthfulness, it also suggests a complexity to the writer of what he's wanting to venture toward.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because I guess that's what I'm trying to pin down. Is he like, well, he's just getting going as a writer, so he's trying to figure things out, or he's totally figured it out and he's intentionally trying to find all these different vocalities? And I love that he would be, even at the very beginning of his career, he knew exactly what he was doing, rather than he's flailing around trying to have all of these different voices. I guess one of the effects is that if you call this volume In Our Time, and we're all over the map or all over the globe, and we are hearing all these different voices, you're saying in all of our time, in the world's time, not just, this is not an American provincial attitude. This is a completely global analysis about what's going on in the post-war world.
It's amazing. I mean, he kind of makes the point, as we've been thinking through the setting, he's kind of making that point, isn't he? We have, I guess, a French point of view at the beginning. We have potentially an American viewing Spanish bullfighting ritual after that. We have a focus on Greeks in this evacuation during the Greco-Turkish War. And now we have British soldiers. So absolutely, the American is not centered here.
The last point about this idea is that that phenomenon means something when it serves as an interchapter in the longer In Our Time of 1925, when it's breaking up the end of something in Indian Camp and Big Georgia River and all these Nick Adams stories and all these longer narratives. But when you're reading them 18 in a row, as we're doing, it has a completely different effect. It's almost like a collage, which we'll talk about some other time, some other episode, about the cover, which is almost like a conglomeration of different images.
Yeah, the quite literal collage that readers would have confronted. Yeah, we'll talk about that in a little bit. And yeah, I've been thinking about how these vignettes play out as we're reading them sequentially here, one after the other, without, we might say, the benefit of the entire story punctuating them. How that feel is different, what they're doing in a structural way, in a different way here in the lowercase IOT versus in our time versus what they might be doing in the in our time of 1925. And I have some ideas about that, particularly how it might work when we are reading chapter 4 and chapter 5 back to back. And I imagine you're going to have some ideas too. But yeah, it's a very different reading experience.
Yes. In the longer in our time, when you read these two episodes, chapter 4 and chapter 5, that we have discussed, these two anecdotes are chapter 3 and chapter 4. And they are separated by the end of something. So rather than these two anecdotes going consecutively in Mons, and we have the same voice and the same scene, we have these two vignettes interrupted by lost juvenile love in Michigan. Mm. And that is all part of Hemingway's, what would eventually be Hemingway's project in 1925. But we are here to focus on the vignettes.
Yeah.
Actually, before we look at the language, Michael, you mentioned a figure that is one of the dedicatees to the Paris in our time. It is Robert McCallman, who does come up a couple times on One True Podcast. And he's one of the three people that Hemingway dedicated. We already talked about Chink Dorman Smith. So what do you know about Robert McCallman, and what do we need to know?
Yeah, we talked about McCallman a little bit when we were talking about our first of the bullfighting vignettes. If you remember, that was the vignette that Hemingway wrote before he really stepped foot into a ring, into the stands. And so he had to get that one secondhand as well. But, you know, a few things we might want to know, and then I'm going to hand it off to you for, you know, a few more things. But, you know, with William Carlos Williams, McCallman founded Contact Press, which we might know published Hemingway's three stories and 10 poems. Mm-hmm. And so some of those stories would show up in the In Our Time of 1925. And I just referred to one of those stories, and that's My Old Man. We also have Out of Season. So he's one of those dedicatees there, you know, one of the publishers of the city of Paris because of the Contact Press, because of Hemingway's close connection with him due to three stories and 10 poems. And to go back to that second vignette, as we talked about a bit in depth, McCallman financed Hemingway's first trip to Spain, went with Hemingway and Bill Bird to see the bullfights there in the early 1920s. Now, McCallman wasn't just a publisher. He was also a writer in his own right. So, I mean, he wrote a fair bit. What are some things that he wrote?
Yeah. So apparently he wrote a lot of fiction, poetry. The title that I am familiar with, so this is really the only one that I can mention. I'd love to actually, Michael, have somebody on One True Podcast to talk a little bit more authoritatively about this guy. But he wrote a memoir called Being Geniuses Together, which was published in 1938 and was subsequently enhanced with supplementary chapters by Kay Boyle. And the one thing I remember, I did read this a long time ago, and I read that book, and I remember he told an anecdote that I probably will never forget, that he was walking along the streets, maybe I guess it might have been in Paris, but it might have been Spain, and they saw a dead dog, he and Hemingway, and McCallman remembers like recoiling, looking away, and Hemingway's like, no, you must always look at upsetting things to inure yourself. And, you know, Hemingway was really young at the time, and McCallman's like, I was like, all right, I guess that's his attitude. And he tells the anecdote in the context of like, that really was part of how Hemingway approached not just life, and it wasn't just swaggering around, but it was part of his fiction about how to represent violence. And of course, that's got to be the central theme of In Our Time also, which is violence. But anyway, that is probably, if you know one book by Robert McCallum, or maybe I'm projecting, if there's one work that I know of Robert McCallum, it's called Being Geniuses Together.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. I think we talked about him when Mark Lurie was on the show to talk about Louis Scalentieri. So
that's right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So he does emerge. He does emerge sometimes.
He has shown up here and there in episodes, but we have not had a full episode about him.
And when we think about him in the context of Hemingway's early 20s or mid 20s, it's sort of like as the conduit to the bullfights, right? So it's
true.
Right. So that's part of what we can think about. Maybe Dorman Smith's influence on this volume is the war, and McCallum's will be the bullfighting. About chapter five, the thing that strikes me immediately is the voice. How we have a scene of violence told in a distinctly British mannerism, which almost, would you say, accentuates the violence, or it presents the violence in a really unexpected way?
Yeah, it's like exuberant. I don't know. It's the language, frightfully. It was a frightfully hot day.
Right.
Absolutely perfect. Simply priceless. We have that language over and over again. And yet, we also have the same... I say, and yet, because I wonder if it is the same British voice as the one we have before. So let me ask that one question there. But we also have the same language that we have in chapter four. We shows up. We'd jammed an absolutely perfect barricade, and we potted them from 40 yards. There are certain words that we lingered on a fair bit when discussing chapter four, that appear again here, that suggest it's the same kind of British voice, but we don't have those other words that, like you're saying, they are in your face. The frightfullies, the absolutelies, the perfects, and so on and so forth. Do you think it's the same British voicing? I don't know enough about various kinds of British voices, but do you know, do you have a sense if it's the same one, if it's there's a sense of continuity?
I think it's continuity, but it's such an extreme version of it. And so when our narrator is telling this story, he knows what's going to happen at the end. So he's starting with frightfully hot day, and then everything is absolutely perfect, absolutely topping, simply priceless. It's this, everything is going great. And he knows what the last sentence is going to be, which is going to undercut everything that has preceded it. When I think of frightfully, isn't that the adverb that Mike Campbell uses all the time in The Sun Also Rises, right? Is frightfully this, frightfully that. Hemingway must have really been charmed with this Britishism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Hemingway, we know about Hemingway and adverbs. Don't get me started on that again. But... this is filled with adverbs.
Oh, yes.
Intentionally. You know, this is like, that's part of the point of that's clutters up the sketch, because that's how it's being couched.
So at the end, when he says, we were frightfully put out when we heard the flank had gone and we had to fall back, you're saying the speaker has to know from the beginning.
Yeah.
Like there is continuity in that sense. Whether there's continuity between the chapter four voice and this voice, maybe we'll get to that. But there is certainly continuity within this particular vignette. My question, I guess, at this point is, what does it do at that moment at the end to have frightfully appear there? We were frightfully put out. The same word that shows up at the beginning. It was a frightfully hot day. It's bookended by the same word. Does it undercut the significance for the speaker of this retreat happening, or does it make it, I guess, severely understated? Is it ironic? Like, what's the use of that word there?
So I'm going to go with ironic, because frightfully put out, wouldn't you be frightfully put out if you ran out of gas in your car or, you know, the air conditioner guy didn't show up? Like, traffic. These are inconveniences. Meanwhile, these people are dying by the thousands. Losing this battle began a massive retreat. Massive.
Mm-hmm.
And to be frightfully put out, to have the entire, you know, to have the army have to retreat. I view that as completely, it's like the British stiff upper lip, you know, talk about it in such understated terms.
Talk about it in such understated terms and to talk about it in the same way that you talk about how hot it was outside, right? That's what I find is really interesting, is it's the same kind of language that's being used to talk about the heat. So on the one hand, it's a really exaggerated way to talk about the heat.
Yep.
On the other hand, it's a very, as we're saying, it's a very ironic or understated way to talk about massacre or to talk about carnage or to talk about this this retreat that, as we were discussing in Chapter 4, led to this real kind of disillusionment about that first real engagement of the Western, on the Western front.
But at the heart of it, there's also the word frightful.
Oh, yeah.
And as ironic and understated and over-the-top British as the voice is, it's also reminding us that there was fear involved.
Mm-hmm.
And I wouldn't think that Hemingway would look at Chink Dorman Smith as the example of a soldier who was frightened, but it's reminding us that it is a frightening situation.
It's true. I mean, that's true. And I think so many of these vignettes so far, the first vignette where the soldiers are getting drunk on their way to the front, the second vignette exploring how different matadors are reacting to potential right. goring, potential death. So many of these are really exploring the grace under pressure, the question of grace under pressure, how heroic are you going to be? Are you going to behave? And this is just another example of that. And we're going to have more and more of these kinds of vignettes showing up about individuals facing death and how they talk about it, how they physically respond to it, how they physically respond to it in ways that they do not want to respond.
You can get drunk and talk to a horse. You know,
it
can be that level. That could be your outlet for panic.
Yeah. And so this individual who is going to be talking in a certain way or thinking in a certain way about violence, and yet that talk might also betray the way that he or others might actually feel about it. This is all within the realm of what's going on within all of these vignettes.
This episode of One True Podcast is supported by the Hemingway Review, the scholarly journal of the Ernest Hemingway Foundation and Society. Michael and I are excited about the fall 2023 issue with guest editors Ian Marshall and Margaret E. Wright Cleveland, where their theme for this issue is Hemingway in Black and White. It's a fascinating collection of voices tackling a wide range of issues related to Hemingway and race. For this special issue and back issues, please visit hemingwaysociety.org/journals. One True Podcast is proud to announce that this In Our Time episode is sponsored by Simon & Schuster Audio, which provided Stacy Keach's beautiful introduction to today's show. The Simon & Schuster audio collection is an absolute treasure. Check out their entire Hemingway collection of audiobooks, including Stacy Keach's epic performance of all of Hemingway's short stories, collected in the unabridged Short Stories Gift Edition. Michael, the entire Hemingway catalog or selected titles are available for download or on CD, including the legendary Donald Sutherland reading The Old Man and the Sea, John Slattery from Mad Men performing A Farewell to Arms, the late William Hurt's brilliant take on The Sun Also Rises, and others.
Absolutely. In fact, I just spent a long car ride across Florida listening to Campbell Scott's reading of For Whom the Bell Tolls, and it was great company.
Visit the Hemingway page at simonandschuster.com to order Hemingway audiobooks from our friends at Simon & Schuster Audio. I think every vignette so far we've talked about pronouns. And so here in Chapter 5, the pronoun we occurs 5 times. They and there occurs 4 times. I does not appear, but there is one unbelievable appearance of the word you. And it says, too heavy to lift, and you could shoot through it, and they would have to climb over it. And I love that, you. For me, because it only exists once, it does put you right there into the action. I mean, what he really means is, we could shoot through it.
Yeah.
Or I could shoot through it. And instead of saying that, he says, you could shoot through it. And I just think that's a masterful touch.
Mm-hmm.
Right in the middle of the sketch.
Yeah, that really is, to have you right there. I wasn't thinking about how I doesn't show up anywhere. Because you're talking about the middle of the text, it makes me think about how many sentences are discussing, elaborating on this barricade.
Yeah.
And that's really the crux of the meat of this vignette is about the barricade. We jammed an absolutely perfect barricade, and I love the word jammed. This is not the first time jammed has entered the vocabulary of a vignette. It was simply priceless, a big old wrought iron grating from the front of a house. They tried to get over it, and we potted them from 40 yards. They rushed it, and officers came out alone and worked on it. It was an absolutely perfect obstacle. How many of these sentences over and over again are describing the barricade, describing one's defensive position where you can shoot through, they have to come over? Really kind of hearkening back to what's going on in chapter 4 with the garden wall, where you are in some ways secure, right? They have to lumber over and you can pot them over and over again. No matter how many come over, you have that defensive position. But I mean, there are 4 or 5 sentences that just over and again are describing this until it kind of turns a 180 right there at the end.
That's a great point. Yeah, the position is secure until it becomes insecure, right? And
right.
There are 11 sentences in chapter 5, and your point is totally convincing that it becomes a sketch about an engineering triumph, or mm-hmm. what they think is an engineering triumph. And then, of course, it's not impregnable.
Mm.
It doesn't last. But when it does, they feel invincible. The connection that you're introducing to the previous sketch also, when they said, we potted them from 40 yards, how he really says 40 yards. And probably Chink Dorman Smith wouldn't have said 40 yards, right?
Mm, right. He probably wouldn't have said that.
Probably would have used meters.
Meters, yeah.
But 40 yards gives me the same sensation of being in a garden behind a wall and just picking people off. Just, mm-hmm. you know, it's just target practice. 40 yards away. Come on.
Yeah.
And it's not you know, you're not being a great sniper if you're doing that. So it's really like it shows you kind of the human contact with the enemy.
Yeah.
And in fact, he says their officers were very fine. He didn't need to add that sentence in there. What do you think that sentence is doing there, that second to last sentence?
I know. There are a few sentences like that. And there's another one about officers that I want to ask you about.
Sure.
It's kind of ambiguous to me. This one, though, I feel like there's, as you just said, there's a real sense of pride in this military strategy, the engineering triumph, like you said. There's also a sense of appreciation for military strategy, it seems, even when that is like the opponents.
Yes.
The opponent themselves, right? There's a sense of appreciation on both sides of the line, right? To say, oh, they were very fine officers, right? On the other side of the canal or the other side of the bridge. It seems like that's what's going on. I don't know if you read it the same way, but it seems like it's a really interesting moment because, as we have just been talking about, it seems like it's about a perfect barricade until it's not perfect. But there's that one sentence there that's kind of sandwiched in between that reversal to the plot, and it's that statement.
I think it's a historical reality that the German officers were very brave, and they did do these heroic things. Some of them died doing it. But in order to get past this barricade, they did some incredible things. It's more true of Hemingway than false that in his depictions of battle, he always praises the enemy mm-hmm. when they deserve praise. He would rather praise a member of the enemy that is behaving nobly and courageously than even a member of his own side who is, you know, immoral or cowardly.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of the writing I'm thinking about, as I imagine you are too, but about something like Snows of Kilimanjaro, right? Where there's thinking about, there's the enemy, but the enemy is also a counterpart in war. And therefore, you've shared something together.
That's right.
Therefore, you can make statements like this that do not contradict the fact that you're also the enemy of the German side in this case, because we're from a British perspective. Yeah, I think it's a phenomenal line there. But it does give us a sense of how this particular voicing, like I said, I think it's an exuberant kind of voice that really does seem to, they want to take pride in, praise, whether it's the engineering kind of strategy, or in this case, what the other side has been doing. There's a moment, though, that I just find really interesting, and here it is. They rushed it, comma, and officers came out alone and worked on it. So I guess I'm wondering, why are the officers coming out alone? I would imagine there are other soldiers who would be coming out and not the officers by themselves. It's just strange to me to have officers coming out by themselves to work on it. And then the other question is, what does work on it mean? I mean, it's such an, it by itself is such a vague phrase, and we've had other vague kinds of phrases. Can you shed any light on this?
No, but I'll tell you what I can read. When I hear worked on it, I think they removed it or they did something to circumvent it. And they were trying to figure out how to penetrate it. And they ultimately didn't get through the obstacle. They got around it. But he is praising the officers for their bravery. Maybe the officers went and not like the privates, not the subordinate people. The officers like, no, we're going to do it. Maybe that is what he is suggesting. I want to say one other thing about that sentence, which I agree is totally fascinating. But before I do, I am looking at the Scribner's paperback of In Our Time, and it says they rushed it, comma, and officers came out along. And you said alone.
Yeah.
And then I'm looking at the Library of America, edited by our friend Robert Trogdon, and he has alone. So where are you getting alone and along? And is this a controversy or can we make it one?
Well, we can make anything a controversy. So I am getting alone from, this is the Finkavahia edition. It's alone. I have the recently published In Our Time Norton Critical Edition, edited by Jerry Kennedy. That's alone.
Does along make sense or does alone make sense? Alone would make sense if we read it the way the officers are like, you know what? We're going to handle this. Mm-hmm. Came out along mean anything to you? Because we have talked about how Hemingway kind of tacks on unnecessary prepositions. So that might be another evocation of that.
It's weird if it's came out along, but if it's came along, that would be one thing. But if it's came out along, I would wonder along.
Yes.
What? There needs to be something more to that. I like the idea of, and I think we have three, maybe more books. I've got to go back on, I have to go to my shelf, alone is the word. But I do like the idea of came out alone because it suggests that the speaker is again taking pride in the fact it's the officers having to come out.
I agree.
And try to dismantle
it. To me, that's the convincing aspect of it. This could be something for Milton Cohen when we have him on. We might want to put this down as one of the many questions we have for him. Can I just add on to this sentence? In chapter 5, there are three commas. And I think they're very interesting commas. They're three of the most interesting commas you'll ever see. So he says, they tried to get over it, comma, and we potted them from 40 yards. The next comma is, they rushed it, comma, and officers came out alone and worked on it. And then the final one is, we were frightfully put out when we heard the flank had gone, comma, and we had to fall back. So yeah. I'm thinking that the first two commas, they tried to get over it, and we potted them from 40 yards. They rushed it, and officers came out alone and worked on it. It almost feels like the commas are indicating some sort of time gap. They're spending time trying to get over it. But then after the comma, this is what happened. This is the consequence. We potted them. They rushed it, and we can, like, the comma is occupying the time that they are rushing the obstacle. And then we get the consequence of that sentence. Does that resonate with you, the way that commas appear in this sketch?
It does, that there's time between. They tried to get over it, and we potted them. Yeah, I think there's a little bit of time between those. It's interesting in its own right that there are three that are taking place in a very similar way. They, and then we.
Yes.
And then we were frightfully put out when we heard the flank had gone, comma, and we had to fall back.
If you look at the fifth sentence, too heavy to lift, and you could shoot through it, and they would have to climb over it. If you could pick one sentence in this vignette that needs a comma, it would probably be the fifth sentence, but there is none. And you wouldn't necessarily need any of those other commas, but they probably provide some kind of a logical...
Yeah. And Hemingway's done this before, where things can just be fragments. So you could also expect that too heavy to lift could just be by itself. We've seen that in the one on the evacuation, right? One of the things I was also thinking about is the fact that this begins not with the garden, it begins with the heat, right? We're not entering a garden. The first thing we learn about is that it is a frightfully hot day. Is it important that it is hot? Nowhere else in the episode of this vignette does heat really show up. Officers aren't sweating. We don't see beads of sweat coming off of them, right? So I guess one of the questions that I was thinking around is it actually important? And if so, why is it important? What is it doing? David Wyatt has this really interesting idea that in our time of 1925, we have the stories that are like the waking life of the characters,
yes,
and the vignettes that are the kind of the dream sequences, right? And we might see that really remarkably in something like Big Jordan River, right? Where Nick falls asleep, vignette. Yep. And we're of course going to get to that vignette later on. So I won't say anything more about the vignette. But what's really interesting is when we move from that vignette into Big Georgia River Part 2, one of the first things we see when Nick wakes up is that the tent was starting to get hot. So this is not to make a case that every single time something, you know, reality enters in, it gets warm, or that if we could kind of have a heat map going on, that heat's there when reality kind of enters the scene. But I think it's interesting that we have two parts of Big Jordan River. We have these twinning vignettes here, and these vignettes, maybe unlike the others so far, are about dreams, right? They're about illusion. They are about kind of the foolish naivete of the early parts of the war. And then we have, toward the end of the second one, we have that, we might say metaphorically, this kind of heat that's coming in, which is, in a way, that flank coming, the retreat that has to enter in. It's just a thing that I hadn't noticed before, this kind of really interesting intersection between these couple and then what's going to happen way later on in...
Yeah, that's a great point. It's August 1914.
Yeah.
We're dealing with a big iron grating that you can feel the heat with, you know, from the day. I think that's great. I would also add to that, we have one of the, I guess, stereotypes of Hemingway is that he always returns to these particular adjectives. And we have five of them in this sketch: hot, big, old, heavy, fine. So, I mean, this is probably for his whole career. Like, I'm including A Movable Feast with this, where he always resorts to these adjectives that you wouldn't think are very descriptive. In fact, you'd think they're almost kid-like because they're so basic. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, he always returns them as frightfully hot. The officers were very fine. It was a big old wrought iron grating, too heavy to lift. So it really does stick to these absolute basic things. And then we have these, as we started our conversation with, we had these adverbs sort of piled onto them. Mm-hmm. So it's quite a striking effect in this sketch.
Why is he doing it? I know this could be an episode on its own, yeah. Like why the adverbs that he's choosing, but why these adverbs in this particular vignette, or what are they doing?
I'm happy that we covered frightfully. I would say usually when he says that absolutely topping, so think of what the word absolute means.
Yeah.
Absolute is an empirical fact. There's no wiggle room there. There's no arguing with it. And of course, so here he's using it ironically, that the barricade was absolutely topping. But of course, a few sentences later, the army is in retreat. So it couldn't have been all that topping. The idea here is that absolutely isn't always absolute. Mm-hmm. However, do you remember the scene when Jake and Count Mippopoulos are talking in his apartment in Paris, and they're talking about champagne and the values and all this stuff? And Count Mippopoulos says, you see, Mr. Barnes, it's because I've lived so much that I know the values, or that I can spend money on drinking. Don't you find it that way? And he says, yes, absolutely. And I swear, I think he actually is sincere when he says that. I don't think that's an ironic absolutely when Jake says it. I think that's one of the most important words in the text, actually.
I know that moment that you're talking about. And I see a lot of, like you're saying, I see there's so much irony here, but at the same time, like you're saying, so much for that character, so much sincerity in the moment to bring those couple things together. Right. It may be irony from a certain perspective, but within the moment itself, there's a kind of genuineness of wanting it to be so, wanting it to be this barricade that holds in this case, mm-hmm. even though it isn't. And then with this particular house itself, this big, old kind of house, to me, we've had episodes on Cezanne and other kinds of influences, but how these, in this case, what would seem like basic kinds of adjectives or basic kinds of shapes can, if done well and if augmented in certain ways in a sentence and kind of reshaped in subsequent sentences, how those can become so powerful. I'm not necessarily saying he's thinking about Cezanne here, but I'm saying it's just so interesting how he can take something that seems so rudimentary in his writing, and he can keep kind of shifting it around within a sentence and surrounding sentences and do just really important things with it. The last thing I will say, just because I didn't mention it earlier on, and this is just for the sake of anybody wanting to read more about it, and I had just come across it recently, is in the selected letters to Max Perkins. This is on the 5th of May, 1938. He's talking about this retreat here.
Oh.
And so he says, so this is certainly in the context of the Spanish Civil War. He's talking about the Italians on the Ebro. He's saying, you know, the left flank went down by San Mateo and finally had to give them what they could never take. So he's talking about flanks going. He's talking about retreats in terms of the Spanish Civil War. And what he ends up saying about it is likening that to what happened at Mons. And he said the retreat from Mons was chicken shit alongside of this last show. It's really interesting that in 38, he's still thinking. Like, he's thinking about Mons, and he's thinking about connecting these dots here.
That's great. That is an awesome 1938. Wow. Just to tie up a couple of things, the word priceless is also what Jake says about his date with Georgette. Brett says, have you had a good time? Oh, priceless. You know, think of some of these words, you know, frightfully, priceless, absolutely, as Hemingway often puts them in, you know, to kind of add this little slant to it. So I'm not surprised that we're seeing a lot of these wrinkles to the sketch. And then I also wanted to point out that if you look at the last sentence of chapter 5, so the last sentence is 19 words and 18 are monosyllables.
Mm.
So you remember, like we were talking about, like they all came just like that, like put out when we heard the flank had gone and we had to fall back. Like those last, 15 words are all monosyllables. Like either sonically or rhythmically, he is employing those monosyllables as like the drum beats to end the sketch.
Sure. We were also asking with the end of chapter 4, how you read that final moment, right? How you read it as, like you said, that monosyllabic sound of drums or gunfire. And I'm sitting over here wondering if he's in all of this first encounter. We had, I think, very different. Maybe there's a way in which in the Venn diagram, there's something connecting them. But with this one, you know, where do we see it ending? Is the narrator kind of feeling something similar at the end of this chapter 5 that seems to be connected with chapter 4? Because in terms of the words that you've just pointed out, right, absolutely, to see it in Sun Also Rises can be really genuine and authentic. Priceless doesn't have the same kind of ring. So tonally, like we can again be all over the map. By the end, do we have a sense that the narrator, the feeling is cohesive in some way, or we know where we are at the end in terms of how the narrator's thinking about the war?
I think you're asking the exact right question. So the way we have to think about this is in the same context as we were talking about the other retreats in Hemingway's fiction. So Caporetto or the Greco-Turkish War in both the journalism and chapter 3, those retreats were catastrophic. You know, those retreats, I mean, these guys isn't the retreat 250 miles after this battle? You know, this is not like, oh, we had to fall back. No, they had That's to far. Go all the way back into France. I would think that this is understatement, but if you knew Chink Dorman Smith, if you knew the historical reality of what happened, this is like a frightfully put out. They were beyond frightfully put out that their entire lives were going to change. The war effort was going to change. So I think that he is a frightfully hot day. That's probably accurate. Frightfully put out. That's probably a massive understatement.
Yeah. And I think and the last thing I'll say, which is connected to what you're saying, is I think this one shows something that runs through so much of Hemingway's writing, and that is the literary value of the retreat itself, right? Yeah. That he is, I mean, we've seen it with the evacuation. He is so interested, not just in the clash of forces when it comes to kind of war proper, but the aftermath of it or those other parts of it that we might not normally think of when we think of war literature or a scene of battle. And that is, in this case, the scene of the retreat, right? It has immense literary value for him.
Michael, it was absolutely topping having this conversation with you.
Priceless, I would say.
It was simply priceless. Thanks, Michael.
Thanks.
And thanks to you all for listening in. This episode and past episodes are available at onetruepod.com or wherever you get your podcasts. Our book, One True Sentence, Writers and Readers on Hemingway's Art, is available anywhere books are sold, so we encourage you to pick up a copy or two and enjoy more Hemingway talk. You can also support this podcast by leaving us a rating and telling your friends all about us. Feel free to write us at onetruepod@gmail.com. That's the number one, truepod@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. This episode and all In Our Time episodes are made possible by a generous grant from Indiana Humanities in cooperation with the National Endowment for the Humanities. This show is also supported by the Hemingway Society and Florida Gulf Coast University. Join us next time as we continue exploring Hemingway, his life, his work, and his world. Until then, I'm Mark Chirino with Michael Von Cannon, and this is One True Podcast.